It's interesting giving a talk following on from Padmavajra these days. Padmavajra is so immersed in the lineage of inspiration, he doesn't know what he's going to say until he's finished. So, you know, if you're following on, you don't actually know what you're going to say until, you know, you've heard what he's going to say. So I did come with a talk prepared, and actually I'm going to pretty much give that talk, but I was a bit wary of giving it a title until, you know, I knew what he'd said and what I was going to say. And then I came up with the ground. It sort of works. It actually made quite a good name for a sort of folk rock album, wouldn't it? If it hasn't already. Okay, so we're here to celebrate 40 years of Padmaloka as well as hear Dharma. And Padmaloka's probably played a significant part in the lives of everyone here. It certainly played a significant part in my life since 1978. In 1978, I was living in Ireland in a community with people with learning difficulties run by followers of Rudolf Steiner. And I'd come to the point where I was clear, you know, I was never going to be an anthroposophist. I mean, just a word like that is really... never mind what they believe. I told them when I went there, if I was anything, I was a Buddhist. And by the time, by that point, 3 years on, I realised, yes, I was a Buddhist and I wanted to be around other Buddhists. So I wrote around to a number of different Buddhist groups. I had a couple of friends at that time who were running what they call the Scientific Buddhist Association. And they'd been to the opening of the London Buddhist Centre and came over to visit and told me about the FWBO, and they thought, you know, I might fit in with that lot. So amongst others, I wrote, I think, Sami Ling and a couple of other places, just saying that I had a young family, I wanted to be around Buddhists, interested in community and so on. And I got a couple of newsletters back from the London Buddhist Centre. And in one of these newsletters, I read about Sangharakshita. And Sangharakshita was interesting. I mean, he was obviously a Buddhist. He'd spent quite a bit of time in India, and I'd spent over a year travelling around in India. So, you know, that was one mark, good mark. He had long hair in some of the pictures, you know, 60s, all that, long hair, two good marks. And then thirdly, he was English. And in India, I'd met all sorts of interesting gurus and lamas and so on. And it, actually back in the UK as well. But I'd always felt it was difficult to really, as it were, communicate myself to them in a way that they sort of saw me and could tell me what I needed to do. And I thought, well, you know, Sangha actually, he's English. Maybe he'll be able to, you know, give me some real guidelines and guidance, because I was getting to feel it was time I had some of that. And so one afternoon before going to milk the cows on a Sunday afternoon, I wrote this long rambling letter to this Sangharakshita character. I think I must have written it off, sent it off to the London Buddhist Centre, but the reply came from Padmaloka in Norfolk, part of the world I'd never entered into my psyche before. But anyway, Sangharakshita said, he'd read the letter. It was rather long. If he was going to reply to all my points, he'd need to write 3 or 4 books. He didn't have time to do that, but as I'd asked for advice, he'd give me some. And he simply stressed the importance of being around people who share your ideals and values, especially people a bit further on the path than yourself, and how easy it is for your ideals and aspirations to come to nothing if you don't have that. And that really struck a chord with me. And on the strength of that, I came over on a reconnaissance mission, visited the London Buddhist Centre and Norwich, and a few months later moved to Norwich with my young family. And fairly soon after that, I came out to Padmaloka for the first time and met Bhante. Bhante by then was already in his English country gent incarnation, so I was a little bit disappointed. I never met the sort of anarchist monk. But, you know, English country gent did very well. And, yeah, a bit later on, I was on my first retreat here in that summer. Padmaloka was a lot smaller then. You know, all of this was still owned by a farmer, the barn, all those buildings. Basically, there was the walled garden and then that little courtyard behind the big house, which was closed off. And there was a coach house, stables, a little shed and a garage. And when you walk down the slipway between the shower and the toilets, you can just see the remains of a sort of runnel, which was the green sliding door of the garage that was up there. So, you know, Padmaloka was so much smaller. And when, you know, when there were retreats and events on, we were really packed in. The main shrine room was the library at the front of the house. It's difficult to believe, isn't it? That was the main shrine room at that time. And, yeah, these buildings were all, just farm buildings. There were horses kept in the dorms there. And Ivan, did any of you remember Ivan with his wheelbarrow? Sort of wandering around, cleaning the sheds out. He was a sort of simple-hearted Norfolk country lad. Just sort of did odd jobs around the place. But he wasn't completely that simple. At one point, he asked the guys if they'd like to buy some potatoes. And I think they thought, oh, you know, Ivan, you know, must have a little allotment of his own. You know, let's help him. But then they started to get a bit suspicious when he kept turning up with another sack full of potatoes in his wheelbarrow. So, you know, questions were asked, and it turned out that the local farmer, you know, goodness of his heart, had said to Ivan, oh, just help yourself to potatoes. I don't think he expected Ivan and his mum to eat that many. But, that little way of making money ran out pretty quickly after that for Ivan. But yes, it was a very different place. A couple of plots were sold down that end, just beyond the car park, for building. And then these buildings were all bought and slowly done up. And that obviously made an immense difference to the facilities here once that started to happen. Yeah, and so again, a few months further on again, it's probably a year on, I was on a seminar here with Banti on the Song of the Yakhorn. This would have been autumn 1980. And I remember being at the bus stop at the end of that retreat and, you know, all earnestness as one was in those days, telling someone at the bus stop that, you know, I just didn't feel I could leave and be true to myself without asking for ordination. And said I'd ask for ordination, and the person I was talking to said, yeah, I felt just the same. So I said, did you ask too then? And they said no. Anyway, they did get ordained a couple of years later as well. So yes, regularly coming out here after ordination as well, big order weekends, Banti giving a whole series of talks, you know, the twin under the twin sal trees and a case of dysentery. You know, all these weekends were quite events in themselves. You know, Padmaloka really seemed like, you know, one of the places Banti was really giving us a lot of himself, a lot of his teachings over quite a period then. And then the, you know, the Mitra Study Leaders course being initiated, coming out, having those study seminar sessions with Banti and so on. So I was living in Norwich, working in the centre, but Padmaloka was almost like this other world that had come out and plug into from time to time. As itself, it went through quite a number of changes, particularly after the whole ordination training sort of fired up here with Subhuti and Sona and Suvadra taking it on, and, you know, Surita and then Padmavajra moving in. So it was that phase, later phase, that I joined in with when I moved here in 95. And yeah, 20 years here and then moving on. So, yeah, just a little bit of a flavour of Padmaloka before going on to the whole talk. It really is a place, a people, an atmosphere. You know, people often say they can just feel it as they move, come in the gate here. You can't pin it down, but you can know. You know, you can know the atmosphere that you're in when you come to Padmaloka. And it's places like Padmaloka, Adisthana, Tiratna Loka, Guhyaloka, probably named quite a few others, where we have a heightened, more focused, more consistent, intense version of what we find actually probably at all our centres, all our communities, retreats, events, gatherings. This is, if you like, what gives our order, our movement, its particular flavour and character. And this, I think, is what I would really think of as the lineage of inspiration. You know, it's this atmosphere that we can move into, touch, and that is alive wherever order members are together practicing, teaching, communicating the Dharma. And this atmosphere isn't arbitrary. You know, Bhante's genius, I think, has been actually seeing into, entering into the Dharma deeply enough, clearly enough, to communicate effectively how we can come together to set up the conditions in which this atmosphere can be increasingly alive between us. And also how, if we stay with it, keep on doing what needs to be done, you know, even despite ourselves, something can start to shift on a quite fundamental level. You know, over time, there can be this reorientation, reorganisation of our being around the Dharma, opening into ever deeper, stronger faith and wisdom. Or put slightly differently, our order and movement, Triratna, is a sort of doorway to the transcendental, very variable in focus, intensity. But yeah, this is what we've inherited, and it's for us to carry forward. And at the heart of this inheritance, its whole raison d'etre, you could say, is this atmosphere, this lineage of inspiration. And as I said, it's not arbitrary, it's not accidental. You know, Bhante has actually spent years patiently teaching us, training us, educating us, helping us to see and understand for ourselves the conditions in which this dharmic atmosphere can emerge. I'm using the term atmosphere, but it's not really quite adequate, is it? I mean, atmosphere can sometimes mean almost like a bit like a mood. It's more like the earth's atmosphere, you know, something in which we live and move and have our being. And also the suggestion of something emotional, even aesthetic, you know, a quality of light, expansiveness, and so on. In the Celtic tradition, they speak of thin places where one can easily reach through or be reached through from other realms, other worlds. And, you could say we have the dharmic equivalent in our order and movement. We create these thin places where the influence of the transcendental can begin to sort of exert its pull, shape and guide us. You know, we're drawn towards that transcendental mode of being. So we set up and we keep on renewing and strengthening the conditions in which this can happen. And in the rest of the talk, I'm going to go over some of the most important of those conditions in the way of teachings, practices, institutions that make it possible. So, yeah, it's as if this lineage of inspiration is, if you like, at the heart, and the lineages of teachings, practices, institutions, they're the support, the ground that make it all possible. And it is familiar ground I'm going to be covering. It's going to be a little bit of a stating of the obvious, but then, you know, we do all have these tendencies to forget, to take for granted, to get distracted, settle down, get confused, think we know best. So, you know, it's always good to be reminded, isn't it, of the basics. There's that little phrase, no higher teachings, just deeper understandings. And the longer I live with the Dharma, just realise how much truth there is in this. It's not just a neat little sort of aphorism. It really does embody a profound truth. You know, I have a sense of myself moving, if you like, from a naive simplicity. You know, you first read the Dharma, it's all wonderful, you're going to be enlightened in, well, if not 6 months, in a couple of years. You know, it's all so obvious, and how can people be so stupid and not do anything about it? And then, you know, you actually enter more deeply into the Dharma, and it's not quite as easy as you thought, and there's all this stuff, you know, Hinayana, Mahayana, six of this, whatever. You know, it all can seem to start to get rather complicated. But then the more I found I've lived with the Dharma, it all actually starts to simplify again. It comes down, I think, you could say, to a sort of simplicity of heart, where you have this sense of a unifying thread running through all the Dharma. And yeah, it's somehow that complexity resolves it back into a much deeper simplicity. So, yes, this teaching of the four lineages of inspiration, teachings, practices, institutions, it's one of those that Bhante has come up with in more recent years, really just to help us to articulate, explain ourselves to ourselves. You know, here we are, something's grown up with us, within us, around us. If we're going to really carry it forward effectively, we really need to understand more clearly and deeply who we are, what we have, how it all works. Just really get a clearer sense of what we are as an order and movement. But of course, these four lineages, teachings, practices, institutions, inspiration, they're not really separate. They all interweave, feed back into each other, amplify each other, illumine each other. But still, a useful way of helping get a sense of who we are, and what needs to be done. So the lineage of teachings, those teachings that give our order, our movement, its particular shape and emphases. And begin with a really obvious one, the centrality of going for refuge, the importance of commitment, wholeheartedness, an echo from Pamavajra's talk yesterday there. So it's no use just passively being in the atmosphere of a centre, a community, of the Sangha, of a retreat. Or at least there's only limited use. We can enjoy positive states for a while, but it just comes and goes. It's possible actually to be around Tri Ratna FWBO for years and no real fundamental shift take place if one's sort of there somewhat passively. So we need to be committed. We need to be really trusting in and working with the process of the spiritual life in a way that keeps us going through all the ups and downs of a life. And it is a pretty untidy business for most of us. You know, I've sometimes described my experience of the spiritual life as alternating between this sense of pushing this great boulder up a rather muddy slope, and I just don't feel I can't stop, because if I do, I'm just going to start sliding back down and get squashed. You just have to keep going, and then it changes, sometimes almost unpredictably, and suddenly I'm sort of surfing the sort of joyful waves of the Dharma. Life's wonderful, the sun's shining, and then it can flip back again. I think the shifts have been much less extreme as time has gone on, but it still can have that quality in life. If you're really working away at the spiritual life. So, you know, the thing of not getting downhearted when it's difficult, not getting intoxicated when all is going well. So one teaching flows into another. Commitment needs integration. Yeah, we all know, again, integration, another of these basic teachings. The need for awareness, mindfulness, consistency, and continuity of purpose. knowing ourselves well enough in an everyday psychological level, not to identify with whatever states arise. You know, just to do what we said we'd do, to keep building faith, confidence, trust in the whole process. Based on this deep intuitive response to the Dharma, educated through applying our reason and weighed up in our experience. So yes, we develop this capacity just to keep going when we don't know what on earth is going on. Because parts of us do remain hidden for a long time. Samsara runs deep. Sankskaras run deep, pulling and pushing us all over the place. And we need enough trust and confidence in the path, in our whole context of practice, just to hold our course. And then commitment, going for refuge. For us, it's not just to anything. There's many useless things you can commit yourself to. I'll leave you to think up your own examples. But there's also many sort of good, worthy things, you know, just from, I don't know, running a marathon, you know, sort of test yourself and so on, to bringing up children, doing a good and useful job, being a friend, commitment to family, all good as far as they go, but also limited if those alone are what is intended to give your life its real meaning and purpose. So our primary commitment as order members is to the three jewels, to the Buddha, this possibility of freedom, love, creativity, kindness, profound knowing and seeing. You know, we need to be caught by that, drawn by that. Commitment to the Dharma, to that deep resonance with the teachings of the Buddha and where they seem to lead. And to Sangha, which I'm going to come back to. And we need to know about the crucial importance of living out of our commitment, our going for refuge, in a very immediate and practical way, in how we go about our life, the practice of the precepts, the development of an attitude of metta, kindness, friendliness, generosity, forgiveness. And obviously connected here, another key teaching emphasised by Bhante in Praticca Samuppada, conditionality. Everything is constantly arising and passing away in dependence on conditions. So on a more practical, personal level, this is given expression in the teaching, actions have consequences, and the understanding how we can constantly reshape, reorientate our whole being through the practice of the precepts. And on a more philosophical, contemplative level, Praticca Samuppada points us towards the insubstantiality of all phenomena. There's nothing to hold on to, no ground on which we can plant ourselves, ultimately take a stand. Just a brief aside here, I've really been taken over recent years by Atisha and his teachings. And some of the things that have really come across. Apparently wherever he went, Atisha taught the importance of kindness. Be kind. Again and again, he taught kindness. And then he taught the importance of going for refuge. Really emphasised that. So he was often known as the Refuge Lama. And then he also really emphasised actions have consequences. So he was also known as the Karma Lama. And yeah, when he heard this, he was actually very pleased. You know, he's quite happy to be known for those things. And also, what I read of his teachings, there's a lovely sort of expansive warmth and quality to them. And I just find a real resonance with what I read of Atisha and the whole, you know, like mood of the teaching and quality of the teaching as communicated by Bhante. And you know, I find a very sort of pleasing resonance between those two. So yeah, we can begin to appreciate this whole matrix of teachings that we actually take for granted. You know, we've grown up in the Dharma with them. They're second nature to us, and they grow out of each other, they amplify and inform each other. Yet these teachings are so essential to what has unfolded and continues to unfold between us. And the same with the lineages of practices. I probably need to say less here, but you know, just like the basic meditations, mindfulness of breathing, metta bhavana, obviously very bound up with living out, applying, exploring the teachings I've already mentioned. And again, it's so easy to take for granted what we have in this foundation, this ground, in these basic practices. It was very sobering what happened in the first flush of excitement around pure awareness, where, you know, some order members, even at some centres, people didn't want to teach any bhavana anymore. And there was quite a polarisation and a sense of, you know, losing a shared ground even for a while. Just realising how vulnerable, actually, you know, our shared ground is if we don't really value it and appreciate it. You know, in recent times I've been in Finland and there's been Finns, Estonians, Swedes, English, all together on retreat. And, you know, doing the same meditations that they've learnt in their different countries. Doing the same pujas in their own native languages, the positive precepts in their own native languages. And then in Poland, you know, a retreat with Poles, Russians, Ukrainians, English again. And this summer there may be some Hungarian gypsies joining us as well. But it's quite something. You know, we have these same practices. We can just sit in a room together and meditate, and we know we're actually doing the same practices. And, you know, through translation, we can sort of share and deepen our understanding of what we're doing together. You know, you do hear people come up now and again, or come across a way of doing the mindfulness of breathing or the metta bhavana, that, you know, that, oh, it really works for them, it suits them better. And then start thinking, oh, well, that's the way I'm going to teach it at my centre or whatever. But, you know, it's just preference. It's just preference. And I think it's so important we keep that shared framework of the way we do the practices. You know, we've got this framework, this shared ground that we can come back to again and again. You know, if I think when I was first taught the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana, it was actually very, very dry, very sort of, in a way, almost mechanical the way it was taught. But over the years, you know, there was a whole realm of exploration went on at Vajraloka and opening up of the practices over time. And, you know, you can work with the same framework, but actually do the practices in a completely new spirit and with a much deeper understanding. I think having that framework in which that deeper spirit and understanding of the Dharma can unfold, it's so important. And the same with pujas, the dedication ceremony, the positive precepts, the same practices, even different languages, form just opening up into a shared meaning. You know, you can say one practice, one bodhicitta, connecting us all at a profound level. When we come together on retreats or when we're practicing quite independently in centres all around the world, somehow still that sense of deep unity. And the same with order practices. You know, there's the six-element practice. There was a period, probably through the late 80s and 90s, when actually it seemed to slip off the radar for quite a few of us. And there was a really important dimension, I think, there of shared practice, of how to enter into that whole vipassana aspect of the Dharma that sort of receded into the background and actually meant that there was something relatively weak in our sort of collective understanding and experience. And I think that did lead to others going off to explore in different areas. And for me, it was a tremendous relief, actually, to really rediscover the six-element practice when I started doing Gukhyaloka courses after I moved here, and for it to, yeah, really begin to sort of unfold again in meaning and significance. And it does seem, you know, much more alive between us all again, and that whole dimension of practice that it opens up into. And with sadhana, You know, again, in recent years, we do seem to have a much clearer understanding of the place of sadhana, whatever form that might take in our whole system of practice. You know, just as a practice around which all others can constellate and which facilitates that daily connection with the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, with a way of being that's beyond the everyday and familiar, you know, a reminder of our highest values and purpose in life, if you like, a direct personal connection with the lineage of inspiration, you know, we can turn to strengthen day by day. On to the place of the imagination, that faculty that brings together reason and emotion and enables us to reach beyond the limitations of our present mode of being and open to something other. They're very much connected with Shraddha. And this is a theme returned to again and again by Bhante. You know, involving the emotions, the emotional reaches and depths in the spiritual life, the place of arts, beauty, love, a sense of wonder, awe, mystery, beauty, and the whole place of faith and devotion, including devotional practices. And with our Western rational secular background, I think it's easy for us to fall into a more heady approach to the spiritual life. In a recent conversation with an order member, friend of mine, Bhante said to him, "For every ounce of insight, we need a ton of samatha." You know, just that real sense of the importance of that richness, emotional richness, warmth, depth, that we're really recognising how important that too is unfolding. And I found it interesting reading bits of writing in various order forums over recent times. You know, there's people who've obviously had really significant insight-type experiences, and they're writing about it, they're trying to explore it in terms of the traditional teachings, but I find sometimes the writing can get really opaque, really difficult to read. And I can't help but feel there's a dimension still missing. You know, really good people. But somehow the need for this much broader basis in samatha, merit, love, kindness, friendliness. And this does seem to be one of those qualities that Bhante has been able to bring again and again in his communication of the Dharma. Able to communicate profound teachings with a sort of lightness and warmth and ease that actually makes it seem immediate and accessible rather than this sort of slightly heady, opaque communication. And so on to Sangha, spiritual community. And here again, a real overlap of all the lineages of teaching, practices, institutions, inspiration. So spiritual friendship, we could say, is the crucible, the container in which the whole process of the spiritual life, individual and collective, takes place. We can talk about it endlessly, but in the end, we have to do it. We have to be a friend, live a Dharma life in open-hearted connection with others. And there's something very ordinary and also extraordinary when we step beyond the everyday niggles and difficulties. You know, I just sort of wonder sometimes at the easy depth of love, understanding that's there flowing between those that many of us in the order. You know, if we can just get below that surface of everyday niggles. There was a convention at Stonyhurst a few years back now, quite a few years back now. Stonyhurst is a Jesuit college in the north of England. It's the original of Gormenghast, if those of you are familiar with Mervyn Peake. It's where Mervyn Peake actually went to school. And it's full of labyrinthine corridors, stairs, buildings. You know, you go around a corner and there's a reproduction of Michelangelo's Pieta sort of there suddenly confronting you. And there was a puja in the gym towards the end of that convention. We were chanting a Padmasambhava mantra, and order members were just coming forward to make offerings in order of their ordination. And it was as if a doorway into that third order of consciousness just swung quietly open. And there really was quite a sort of lovely, indefinable atmosphere just there. You know, it was sort of unexpected, but there it was. We were all just in that. You know, so the lineage of inspiration, if you like, was just there. We'd sort of come together, we'd done all the right things, and there it was. So, pressing on again, the lineage of institutions. So to start with, there was just Bhante, a few friends and disciples. It was all pretty informal. But, you know, pretty quickly, there was need for more structures, more institutions, you know, centres, communities, businesses, a mitra system, mitra conveners meetings, chapters, chapter conveners meetings, international order conveners, ordination training, private preceptors, public preceptors, a college of public preceptors, a chairs meeting, an international council meeting, the uniting the order. You know, all these sort of frameworks, institutions have just been steadily growing that actually facilitate communication, that connect us across the globe and help hopefully maintain a certain unity of vision. And this is really quite a task. You know, the college recently initiated a pilot project to see if we could integrate direct pointing, insight inquiry into the whole order system of teaching and practice whilst maintaining that integrity and unity. And it's gone very well. You know, it really does seem to have been very successful, but it's been a lot of work for a lot of people just making it happen. You know, never mind those who are, you know, just doing the work on the project, just making it happen, setting it all up. So yes, this lineage of institutions, you know, the ways in which we run our whole order and movement. So more usefully, sometimes Bhante's also spoken of a lineage of responsibilities. And I think this maybe captures it better. So you've got men and women immersed in the spirit of the order of the Dharma, taking responsibility within the institutions to make sure they work effectively. And at the same time, that they're never allowed to become ends in themselves. You know, rather working to facilitate an ever more effective interplay of these lineages, teachings, practices, inspiration. So Triratna can remain as a force for good in the world down over the centuries. And there's no guarantees. You know, there's plenty of very powerful forces at play in the world, around us, within us. There's plenty working against making Triratna that force for good in the world. So, and it really is up to us all, down to us all, to serve this lineage of responsibility. You know, actually help it all to happen. The order is unfolding, evolving, and we need to ensure there is this constant deepening, individual and collective, of practice and understanding. And so there's this greater embodiment of the wisdom and compassion of the Buddhas, and this profound continuity and coherence that it can all flow out from. And at the same time, there needs to be this creative unfoldment, you know, how to communicate, how to practice, realize the Dharma in a fast-changing world and in very different cultures and circumstances without going down countless different interesting avenues that actually lead to dispersal and disintegration. So Padmaloka, over the years, has been a place of continuity, of coherence, of creative unfoldment. Bhante spoke in his letter that he wrote for this weekend of it as being a jewel, one of the jewels in the crown of Triratna. But there's many other such jewels, some of them flashing more brightly, others less brightly. But each of them, and actually each of us, providing the conditions where the Dharma can actually shine through. The atmosphere, you know, creating that atmosphere in which people can be drawn in and start to take down those barriers in their hearts and minds and start to unfold into wisdom and love of the Buddhas. So we have this remarkable gift from Bhante, which we can describe in terms of these lineages of inspiration, teachings, practices and institutions and responsibilities. Though in a way it's not really from him. You know, he's, if you like, been the dharmic channel to share it with us. And it's now in our hands. So may we individually and collectively find the courage, clarity, commitment that enables the influence of the Dharma to flow on through us into the world for the welfare and happiness of the many.